Agriculture is one of the world's oldest industries, and throughout the centuries, technological advancements have revolutionized the way we farm. There's the invention of the steel plow in the early 1800s, then the tractor and the combine at the end of that century, and advancements in crop chemicals in the 20th century. In the last few years, something new is disrupting the farming industry and innovating it at the same time, and that's big data. Data that can help farmers pinpoint exactly what to plant on which acres of their land and collect information about crops every second of the day. It's a field, no pun intended, that's generating a whole lot of attention, and Kansas City has the potential to be a leader in this area. Here to help us learn more is Ron LeMay. He's the CEO of FarmLink. That's a Kansas City agriculture startup that's seen exponential growth in the last couple of years. And Ron, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Peggy Lowe is back with us. She's reported on some high-tech farm companies for Harvest Public Media. Peggy, always good to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Peggy, help me out here with some basics. When we talk about big data and the farm, we're talking about what here?
Well, really, this started with something called precision agriculture. And it means kind of
precision
like...
Agriculture is a new term.
Yes, it is. And it's really a thing. And it's been a big thing in farming. And it arrived basically with the advent of GPSs. So you could basically farm by satellite. You know, you could get really great readings of what's going on in your field, whether that's ground temperature or soil or seeds or fertilizer, water, how that's all mixing together. So also now farming has become so high tech because a lot of the machinery has sensors. So that machinery, too, is picking up a lot of that information, and then they're storing that information somewhere. So all this big data is obviously very, very attractive, and it could be very helpful to not just the farmers who are, you know, say, saving money on inputs and increasing their crop yields. It's very exciting for ag scientists and big companies. They see lots and lots of potential when this data from all these thousands of farms is aggregated. They can learn a lot.
And so when these machines are going through the fields with their sensors, they're picking up information like what, the moisture content of the soil? Would that go without saying?
Absolutely. That's exactly what they're doing. Moisture content. How is the nitrogen working as a fertilizer? Where are there rolling hills that perhaps should be tiled? You know, it's really incredible. I was up in Tarkio, Missouri recently, and I couldn't get a cell phone signal within the town, but the guy I was with in his combine was getting like satellite feeds from all over the world, right? So, I mean, it's just this amazing high-tech business.
That's amazing. Ron, FarmLink, you know, your company collects and manages data for farmers. I want to talk a little more about that, but your journey into ag tech is pretty interesting. Your background's in communications. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I actually retired from Sprint in 2003 and decided with my son we wanted to be in the investment business. The first investment we made was in the predecessor to FarmLink, a company called MachineryLink. I've said laughingly from time to time, I wandered into the ag space and for years couldn't find a way out. That's an overstatement. Certainly not true any longer.
What drew you to that kind of business?
The thing that drew us initially was asset utilization. Farmers paying $300,000 for a combine that's idle 93% of the time, rather.
A lot of their big equipment's idle most of the time, right?
Yeah, not like ag. Ag has the worst capital intensity record of all, and it's because it's so fragmented. It's not the farmer's fault. Fragmented, there's an ownership culture. Technology keeps advancing. People want to own the new technology, but they can't share it. They can't share it as well as they can in other places because they need it at the same time in geographic areas. And so it makes utilization really low and becomes a really big burden on farmers. Machinery is 41% of their non-land cost.
So how did FarmLink help them with that?
So what we did was we established a hypothesis we tested and then went and implemented that if we could move the equipment around from harvest to harvest and get four harvest events in a year, we could cover all of our costs and save farmers money by simply increasing the utilization from one harvest to four harvests. And that's what we did.
So you were buying the equipment and then leasing it out in a sense, or renting it out?
Financially, we were leasing it and subleasing it, but that's just an economic financial decision. So essentially, we were buying the equipment and leasing it out. That's correct.
Your first company was called MachineryLink, which you still run today. Is that what MachineryLink does?
Yeah, MachineryLink is in an evolution right now. MachineryLink operates a combine leasing fleet the way I just described. We've also created what we characterize as the Airbnb of ag or Uber of ag, which is a technology company that permits owners of equipment to be matched up with lessees of equipment on a peer-to-peer basis. So rather than us leasing and subleasing, we permit dealers, cooperatives, and farmers on a peer-to-peer basis to match up and transact with each other to achieve that same asset utilization.
Do I get a sense, Ron, was technology slow to come to the farming industry or not?
Technology has been extraordinarily slow in some respects, very fast in others. Peggy referred to some of the advances. Machinery technology has been very good, software related to that, crop science rapidly improving. But what hasn't developed is data analytics. Data analytics is the missing piece. That's what we're trying to supply with FarmLink. Data analytics in agriculture is less developed now than it was, say, 20 years ago in communications, a lot of manufacturing context.
This data that Peggy's talking about, finding out how much moisture is in the soil and that kind of thing, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and I would emphasize one word she used, and that is aggregated. It needs to be aggregated data. The data farmers collect individually from their land may be relevant to them in a kind of micro sense. It does not help to develop products to solve these macro issues. If you look at the total factor productivity gains over the last 10 or 30 years and project those through to 2050, when we expect 9 billion people on the planet, the implication is without some other step function reason for productivity improvement, we'll starve almost a billion people. So there's a huge need for a new thing, and that new thing is data analytics.
Well, but there's some issues with that, Peggy, and reading about this issue, you know, last night, getting ready for today, there's a lot of concern about privacy here, and some farmers are saying, I ain't sharing this data. This is my information. Why should I give it up? Am I giving away too much? Am I exposing too much of myself to the world and maybe losing a competitive advantage somehow?
That's right. Harvest Public Media did a story about this in 2014. So this has been a really big concern. And it's kind of like all of us, you know, when we're on Amazon and Google and Facebook, those companies are gathering the information. They are looking at our digital footprint. And then they're trying to come back and say, sell us things based on what we've just looked at or what we're interested in.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing, too, that companies would do. Let's like say it's a seed company. It's going to be really valuable for that seed company to keep information about what a farmer, you know, did well at or didn't do so well at. But there is a lot of distrust among some farmers. So, you know, it's like, if I own that land, do I own that information? If I rent that land, does the landowner own it? Or who has rights to all my information? So actually, Farm Bureau has come up with some guidelines about this. And they've got, I think, some 30 companies to sign on, like the John Deere's of the world, the Syngenta's of the world. And they have set these guidelines, such as the farmer owns that information, the farmer has to give you permission to use it, Mr. John Deere or Mr. Seed Company. And then also the farmer has the right to delete his own information. So there are some guidelines. They're voluntary out there, but privacy, just like in any high-tech industry, it's a concern.
Ron, what's your sense? What percentage of farmers are sort of hesitant to share this information in a way that might provide the benefits that you're talking about just a few minutes ago?
Yeah, in contrast to the impression that's been left, and there clearly have been data privacy issues, we rarely run into it. I've had one farmer in all the time we've been doing this say, I don't want you to collect my data. Now, we give them a really good lease rate on a combine. Our contract integrates data collection. We give them discounts or free products in return for this. So there ought to be a mutuality. It ought to work both ways. But there's a big distinction between what farmers have a right to do. They own the data. There's no question about that. They have to give us permission to utilize the data. We say very clearly on our website, if you want your data back, tell us. We'll give it back. We won't use it except consistently with the permission you give us. All those are basic things, but sometimes they get in the way of what the farmer should do. The farmer's big opportunity for benefit here is to increase productivity, profitability, and sustainability. You do that with the kind of tools that can only be developed if farmers are giving their data in return for some mutual benefit and permitting someone to develop precision agriculture products and services based upon that.
But you're saying there's still an issue inside the industry when it comes to pulling all this information together, and then I gather helping farmers, individual farmers, take advantage of that information?
Yeah, let me give you an example. Yeah, I don't use the word big data because it really, in my mind, evokes garbage in, garbage out. collecting information in ag requires greater care than any other environment I've ever been involved in.
And because?
Because the farmer is controlled in a kind of hostile environment. The condition of the machine that's being operated can affect the quality of data. Farmers are supposed to set on the right crop, set dials to the right crop. They're supposed to calibrate. Some of them do, some of them don't. But if you're on the end of that data stream and you don't know the condition of the combine and you don't know what care the farmer's taking, you have no idea. You get good data and bad data, but you don't know the difference. So we use the term actionable data, which means for some problems it has to be big, but it has to be of a quality to be actionable as well.
And are you getting actionable data?
Actually, the first year we did this, we didn't have a clue how to go about compensating for some of these circumstances. A consequence was we threw away 70% of our data. We have solved those problems by requiring a 300-point checklist before the farmer operates our equipment. We put a device on the combine that monitors for operator changes. With those changes in the last harvest, we qualified 97%. We only disqualified 3%. But we're the only ones, to my knowledge, doing this. So we're the only ones collecting a data set like this that really is actionable, meaning scientifically suited for modeling and addressing the kind of issues Peggy was talking about.
You know, Peggy Lowe from Harvest Public Media, you get the sense that ag is just exploding right now when it comes to all this high-tech stuff. I mean, this kind of conversation is just, I'm almost chuckling to myself listening to you guys talk about it.
It is exploding. And here's a really amazing number, too, that'll also make your head explode. The latest report I've read is that there was nearly $5 billion, that's billion with a B, invested in what's called ag tech last year. And the big guys are getting in, like Google, you know, is investing a bunch of money, too.
Yeah.
So when you see these kinds of investment and when you see the entrepreneurs and the investors so excited, I do think that's really something to watch. It's incredible.
Is the focus, Ron, still pretty diffuse, or do you see all these investors moving in similar directions, or is it all over the place right now?
It's like any other area that's early. They're trying to figure out where to move. There was a big move initially to precision products and services for the farmer. There have been adoption issues with that. As commodity prices have fallen, farmers have gotten more guarded about what they'll spend money on. So that's kind of evolved into farm management system positions. There's a lot of money that's gone into that. But there is a lot of money going in across the system now. Some of it is for addressing not the direct farmer's problem, but problems associated with those who serve the farmer. So we do, for instance, product benchmarking for the large agribusinesses. We do retail-related products for the retailers in the business, all the way up to the food companies. And so a lot of this money that's going in is not necessarily going to the farmer, although a lot of it is. It's going throughout the food chain.
Well, let's walk through some of the basics here before a break when it comes to how technology is helping farmers these days. How about when it comes to preparing a field for planting and how many times fertilizer gets involved here? Peggy, can you help me there just a little bit? How technology helps with that?
So oftentimes farmers can actually look, there'll be something like 3 to 4 screens in their combines. There's an iPad sitting there too. They can see satellite printouts of exactly what's going on in their field, how warm or cold the ground is, how moist it is, how if seeds are starting to sprout, how much nitrogen it's going to need. It's just every kind of conditioning can now be read on these screens just sitting in their tractors, in their combines.
And when it comes to watering the fields?
Same thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
How much rainfall they got, how much irrigation they're going to need, absolutely everything.
When the prime time to harvest the product is?
Absolutely. And it's really interesting to watch, too. I mean, all these colors are coming up from the satellite printout or the satellite readings, you know, on the screens. And it shows which fields have more yields and which fields had more yields last year and this year. And it's really incredible.
And how about when to sell, Ron? Because there's an art and a science to that part of the business, too, that high tech is helping with.
Yeah, and the one issue, when we talk to farmers about what they perceive they do not do well, it's grain marketing. So we actually have a grain marketing product we've developed with DTN called DTN Market Vision that's as sophisticated as anything you'd see a Cargill or an ADM use, and we have farmers adopting it now. In fact, I got
and
call.
It tells them what, Ron?
It tells them the
sell today, not tomorrow.
Means we can't hit the peak all the time.
Of
course. But it tells them what we're doing is we're forecasting the harvest and we're projecting the fair market value of the crop. And then they're looking at on the screen the cash grain price at local elevators around them. So it helps them pick the point to optimize. There's a huge amount of money at stake here. We did a test in Grundy County, Iowa, right in the middle of Iowa, to determine how much farmers would have gotten last year if they had followed this market vision plan in our product versus what they did. It's $45 an acre. So they left $45 an acre on the table
by
ineffective grain marketing.
And when you have 2,000 acres,
it's a lot.
Something like
that's a lot of money.
There's a lot of attention being paid to all the things you guys were talking about, and we do that. We're trying to identify opportunity at the 150 square foot level, not field. Fields are irrelevant. Fields can have 100 bushel difference in a 150 acre field.
Meaning so one part of the field gives you more crop than another
bushel,
part of the field.
Yeah, astoundingly more. 100 bushels an acre difference just in 150 acres. So they're micro environments. And what we're trying to do is do that very precisely so they see not only where their opportunity is, but can determine whether what they did worked, but then we're taking it to the forecasting of the crop and the selling of it. There may be more money in more effective selling than in the agronomy part.
God, this is just amazing. What an interesting conversation. Peggy says something very interesting off the air, this notion of who's driving the tractors across the fields these days and what are the farmers doing inside those cabs?
Right, the satellites now can drive the combines over all these fields. So the farmer can just sit there. And so, like, for instance, when we first started Harvest Public Media 5 years ago, I found a lot of bored young farmers in the combines tweeting up a storm. And so we could check in with them. And because it's so high tech, literally the combine's running itself off a satellite. So he has time to actually do other things.
Is this changing the way we should view the farm these days, Ron? I mean, I have this sense of these guys working all these long hours, but if they're sitting in the cab watching movies on their iPads, that says something else to me about the state of American farming today.
You know, with it on auto steer, they're free to do things they couldn't do before. The ones I've been experienced with are doing productive things. So we got a call the other day from a customer of our grain trading product who was on auto steer going down the field with his iPad and had just made a trade and called us to tell us what he'd done.
Why not?
Yeah,
right?
Why not?
Take advantage of your time. Well, I want to bring Darcy Howe into our conversation now to talk about how Kansas City could really be the leader in this emerging high-tech farming industry. She heads up the KC Rise Fund, which is looking to invest in Kansas City companies and increase this region's economic competitiveness in this area. And Darcy, welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
What is the KC Rise Fund exactly?
Well, it came out of a community initiative called KC Rising, which was led by the Civic Council, Mid-America Regional Council, and the Kansas City Area Development Corporation. And
these guys were seeing potential? These people were seeing what might happen?
They were seeing concern, actually. Kansas City's economy hasn't grown as fast as many of our peer cities, and what could they do about that? So they hired the Brookings Institution and came back with some recommendations. And one of those recommendations is we need more investment in the early stage companies of all sorts. And so Ron actually was the leader of the Innovation and Entrepreneurship Work Group. Ron asked me to come along, and these are the things I was seeing as an investment professional, that there are people who want to help Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
They want to help the economy in Kansas City, but they weren't that comfortable with or familiar with investing in early stage companies. So we have had a little bit of a disconnect between the will and the experience and kind of the guts to take the risks to do that.
Is Kansas City doing enough to show investors around the country that, you know, hey, we're the place to be when it comes to ag tech and big data?
Well, one of the things that we're doing with the KC Rise Fund is we are bringing in outside investment professionals who to look at deal flow here. So we have seven or eight great venture capital firms here in Kansas City, but some of them don't specialize in things like ag, as an example. So we need to find institutional investors outside of Kansas City to get some eyeballs on what's going on here that's pretty cool. And ag is a great example of an asset that we have in Kansas City that why would a venture capital firm that normally would say, well, I'm going to give you money, you've got to move to San Francisco or Boston or wherever. And in this case, why in the world would a venture capital firm in Boston say, oh, you've got to move to Boston when you're an ag company? So it's a natural asset for Kansas City to own, to be proud of, to invest in, and to grow, and to continue to grow our economy so that we can kind of catch up with some of our peer cities who have been kind of on this wave a little earlier than we have.
Ron, I'm wondering, is there enough capital pouring into high-tech farming around the Kansas City area to make this thing work?
No, but there's not enough capital pouring into any early stage area in Kansas City to make it work. So we do.
It's been an issue for some people about the state of things here, entrepreneurship in Kansas City.
I've interviewed over 200 entrepreneurs, and you know their claim is there's not enough capital. I interviewed people who have capital to spend, and their contention is there's not enough ideas. So we need to connect those two. Both of those are wrong. There are a lot of ideas that are investable here. There's a lot of capital that's investable here. It's not organized the way it needs to be organized to match the two of them up. That's what we're trying to address in KC Rising and KC Rise.
So bottom line then, Darcy, how well positioned is Kansas City right now to become an industry leader here when it comes to this whole idea of high-tech farming?
Well, I'd go back to the organization around the animal health side of things.
Which is huge around here.
So those guys got together and really put some organization around it between Manhattan and Columbia and everything in between. And it's a natural extension then. The ag is very related, of course, to animal health. So it's a natural asset that we ought to continue to grow. There have been companies who've come from other parts of the world to have operations here because of this aggregate asset that we have. So it makes sense to grow it.
But if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like we've got a little ways to go. We have some work to do.
The Kansas City is one of the lovely things we all love about it. It's a pretty golly gee whiz sort of place, right? Nobody wants to stick up their hand and say, oh, I'm a rich guy and I'd be happy to invest in things. And many of the families and corporations who are seeking innovation or who are seeking they want to help are not very experienced at this. And so it's going to take a while. One of the things we're doing in KC Rise, which I think is kind of cool, is we're bringing some of the next gen of some of the families of wealth who are a little bit on the sidelines and helping them to feel comfortable with this. They can then take leadership in trying to help grow the early stage ecosystem, and ag would be a very natural place to invest.
I was going to say, tell me about entrepreneurs and what do they still need to learn about when it comes to attracting investors?
Well, first, just because an institutional investor doesn't like their idea doesn't mean the institutional investor is dumb, right? I think we're pretty young in this town in some ways in terms of how we think how special our ideas are. Ideas have to be born global today, right? They have to be big enough and scalable enough and be disruptive enough to get attention from institutional money all over the country and all over the world. And so it's important for entrepreneurs to think about how scalable is my idea. Can I put some intellectual property or IP around that to create some security around my idea? Do I have experience? Investors want to invest in early stage entrepreneurs who've done this before.
Sure.
Who have a team around them that are experienced, who are coachable. Boy, that's one of the things I look for the most is how coachable are they to pivot, because you've got to pivot a lot of times when you're an entrepreneur. And are there multiple exit options? Because when you're an investor, you don't necessarily want to stay with that company till the billion-dollar vision is realized. You want to be an investor to help this company along and make money for whatever period of time that investor thinks is the time that they want to be associated with that company.
You know, Ron, you were once asked for your reaction to the many companies and investors, you know, getting into ag tech, and you said this: my reaction is basically, hooray, the country needs a lot of funds going into ag tech. But again, the scene sounds so chaotic. Is it as chaotic as I sense it is?
All early stages are chaotic. I mean, that's the great thing about them.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a lot of capital that comes in. Some of it is efficiently deployed, some not. But if you move quickly and you can discern between the two, it becomes increasingly efficient. If you wait for it to be organized and non-chaotic, you never do it. Inconsistent with the stage.
So what's your sense of how well Kansas City is doing when it comes to capitalizing on its location to become this hub of high-tech farming and research?
Yeah, the good thing is no one has a better right to this claim than we do. So no one stepped up and preempted this. So it's still ours to claim.
And we haven't claimed it yet, though.
We've claimed kind of intellectually. We haven't claimed it actionably. What we need to do is we need to connect these entrepreneurs and sources of capital together. We need to demonstrate success. Success breeds success. Kind of interesting. I've looked at the numbers that have been announced for capital going into various kinds of businesses here. I had a meeting with 15 guys in my office, and we added up what we'd invested for the last year, and it was almost two times what's been announced. Hmm. Why is that? Because there are a lot of people here who do not want their investments publicized, and yet we need that public celebration of success as a part of a cultural initiative to get people less risk-averse, more aggressive, more adventurous, like they are on the coast, on both coasts.
And the reticence is just based on what, Kansas City nice?
Yeah, this is a conservative town, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have made money and are into asset preservation, a lot of them more than they are into allocating and preserving a practical amount, but then investing some more at risk. We need to change that. We need to change that as compared to a lot of towns, even in our area, or Texas, Austin, Texas is a good example, Boulder, Colorado, even Omaha has made a lot of strides. So I think we know what the formula is, and that's what we're doing in KC Rising. We have to now put it into action.
Darcy, you've noticed that same reticence that Ron's talking about?
Yes, but it's important to know that the KC Nice, I look at KC Nice in a positive way as opposed to a pejorative way. People want to help. They want to come together. Now, there are pockets of people who still kind of want to do their own thing, but the more connected we are, both in capital and the entrepreneurs. And by the way, the other thing we need to celebrate is failure in a way. Ron talks about this a lot in the community, that in other places, when someone fails, it's just the first attempt and they know they're smart. The community knows they're smart enough to come back and do it better the next time. We've got to have to adopt a little bit more of that mentality here. But this Kansas City Nice can be really positive. It's part of an asset we have here in terms of getting people to talk and come together on to solve this issue.
I want to thank Darcy Howe again with KC Rise Fund for coming in and chatting about all this today. Darcy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
And for our listeners, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about high tech and farming and how the two have come together in a big way to change the whole farming industry. If you're a farmer out there and want to talk to us a little bit about how all this has affected your lives, I'd be interested in hearing from you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I wanted to go back, Ron or Peggy, to one of the big concerns that's been expressed about all this data that's being collected out there on all these farm fields across the country. There's this concern that companies, once they obtain it, can now get a jump on the marketplace and get an unfair advantage when it comes to investing because they'll know stuff the average investor wouldn't know. How big a concern is that?
You know, it was a big enough concern for us, and we wanted to put it beside us. We didn't want that interfering with our relationship. And so we made a public declaration. We will not trade on the data. We won't sell it to someone who trades on the data.
But how does anybody know that, though?
They'll have to accept our representation. I guess they could sue us if they have evidence that we're not doing it.
Right.
But we're very honest and straightforward because it's in our interest to be. We don't want trade on the data. And we don't want people declining to give it to us because they're concerned about that.
Yeah.
So we make a public declaration to that extent.
You know, Peggy, I'm wondering, if this whole focus on high tech, does it apply to all types of farming, cattle farming, grain farming? Is anyone getting left out of the picture here?
all kinds of farming, as well as food and food services. Like, for instance, a big thing right now, a big push to in this kind of circle of money and investing is the ability to, say, send what, like, local food, like, so clean food that is not produced with, say, antibiotics or something, and send that to your home, and then you get to make it. That's a big part of the startup genre, too. Drones are a big part of the startup.
I was going to ask you about drones. Where do they come into this picture?
Drones, you know, right now are still very iffy as far as, like, they're super cool, and everybody wants to, like, play with them. Yes. And look at them. And they can gather so much information a lot more easier, especially over the Great Plains where we have these enormous farms. It's still sort of up in the air whether or not they will be effective. When we talked about the nearly $5 billion invested just last year in ag tech, a large part of that was drones and robotics. It was something like $390 million invested just in that.
Drones help farmers how they go up and they take photos of fields. I mean, what do they do for a farmer?
They can do a number of things. They can just have a camera there so they can check on far fields instead of driving several miles out. You know, they can check on cattle. They can check on crops. These guys that I wrote about, they have a company called Fly Ag Tech that's based here. And they were actually former military guys who were both experts in GPS and satellite and reading all kinds of information off drones that they learned in the military, and now they're placing that towards the ag sector. So it's really interesting.
Is learning how to fly a drone for a farmer difficult? Is that tough to do?
Well, farmers can hire guys who know how to fly the drones. Yeah, so yeah. They don't have to fly them.
Yeah, okay. Let me go to some phone calls here. Eric from Harrisonville. Eric, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Go ahead.
I embrace technology. I love it. I'm a farmer. I heard earlier that farmers left $45 on the table in a county in Iowa by not using technology to market their grain.
Right.
So what is the margin? What did that technology cost to make that $45?
Yeah, I haven't asked. That's a great question, Eric. What does the technology cost?
We charge $75 a month for the product that I was referring to then. So according to our analysis, you'd pay $800 a year for this DTN Market Vision. And as we've done back testing to look at its effectiveness over time, farmers could save literally in 1 year $100,000 for a 2,000-acre farmer. So it's a terrific bargain at $800 a year.
So drones, all this computer technology, you're saying it's affordable, generally speaking.
Yeah, well, you need to pick your point. Some of this technology is more developed and more applicable than others are. Drones are going to have a role, in my view, but I had an interesting experience with drones not too long ago. I asked one of the leading providers of drones in one of these universities that has a program, what's the leading application for drones? And he said selfies. It was farmers flying it over their land and waving at them while they took their picture. Hey, it's going to go way beyond that, so I don't mean to demean drones, but it's early.
I got to ask just a final point here. There's so much jargon attached to all this high-tech stuff. One phrase I came across, I'm just curious about, that you can find out information about as machines go across farm fields these days, is something called soil tension. What is soil tension?
People ought to ask our farmer friend here.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Get Eric back.
Eric, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
What's soil tension?
I'm a livestock farmer.
We're all begging off.
Okay, we're all going to beg. The heck with it, Eric.
Compaction.
I would guess it's compaction,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That sounds good.
The amount of clay in the soils, perhaps.
Yeah. Eric, I'm glad you called. Peggy Lowe from Harvest Public Media, always good to have you, Peggy. Ron
Thanks,
LeMay,
Steve.
The CEO of FarmLink, a Kansas City ag startup. Ron, thanks so much for your time
You're
today.
Welcome.
I sure appreciate it.